Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. So for this episode, I'd like to have a guest. He's a filmmaker, documentary maker. He has produced a few films. He's directed and edited the... he's a director and editor known for That Moment On, TV Junkie, and his latest work, Conspiracy Theorists Lie. And I'd like to welcome James K. Lambert to the show.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, great. And you produced this really excellent, I mean, to me, it's an excellent documentary on the Kennedy assassination and how the conspiracy elite has misrepresented. I'm trying to be nice how they... But you say it perfectly. Conspiracy theorists lie. I'd like to, we'll talk about that. But I'd like to talk about the Kennedy assassination.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay. So November 22nd, we're recording this on November 14th. Was the 53rd anniversary of the
52nd.
52nd. I should remember that. I was a year old when it happened. Mm. November 22nd, 1963, President Kennedy, as part of a general tour of Texas, was made a stop in Dallas, and eventually passing through the crowds of Dallas. When he entered Dealey Plaza, three shots rang out. Two of them found their mark in the president. One ended up in Governor Connally, who was in the same car. They sped off to Parkland Hospital, where the president was pronounced dead. The president was brought back to Washington. As this was going on, a suspect was found or was chased to a theater in Dallas, was arrested, Lee Harvey Oswald. Though I don't think he was ever, I don't know if he was formally charged at that point.
Yeah. He was. He was first charged with shooting Officer Tippit.
Right.
And then he was charged with shooting the president.
Right. Okay. So then ends up himself being shot as he's being moved from the Dallas police to the county jail. That's when the, everything, this crazy conspiracy kind of starts getting its legs, I guess. We got this interesting character, Oswald, who I don't think anyone really knew, or it wasn't a lot at the time. They're trying to figure this guy out. What do you think, or what have I missed in...
That's the general overview of what happened. And I do think, you know, the fact that Oswald got killed really gives legs to the whole conspiracy talk. It naturally made people suspicious at the time. But 52 years later, and no evidence to prove that anybody other than Oswald was involved, you know, at some point you got to say, okay, it's crazy that it happened, but it's not entirely implausible that one person shoots the president and another angry person shoots him.
Yeah, because it's... You know, because there was numerous investigations, the Warren Commission, there was the church,
House Select Committee on Assassinations.
Right.
And then the FBI did a report and other agencies did their kind of internal reports. So a lot of people have looked at it.
Right. And even to this day, nothing. I mean, the Warren Commission, and you make it quite clear in the documentary, you know, that much of what the conspiracy people are saying, it isn't there. It isn't in, you know, even though they quote the Warren Commission report, it's not there. It's not in there. That's that's the thing that kind of blows my mind about all this. Because I've been through the Warren Commission report, and I know you pointed out things like the magic bullet. I've seen documentaries and that actually, they've actually replicated the shot, and there was no magic bullet.
Right. And the Warren Commission never claimed a magic bullet. The Warren Commission, right from the get-go, said this is a straight shot through two men. And you get all these phony graphics that appear in conspiracy books and on conspiracy websites and in Oliver Stone's film JFK, and they all represent themselves as this is what the Warren Commission said. But it's not. It's not out of the Warren Commission. It's not a graphic from the Warren Commission. It doesn't represent what they said in the text of the Warren Commission. You know, it's a completely fabricated representation of the Warren Commission.
Right. Yes. I've been reading this this book, The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot. And, you know, I was hoping this thing, actually, I had high hopes for this book because I wanted to, it was supposed to be about Alan Dulles, the CIA, and so on. Mm-hmm. And I get to the point where they start talking. I mean, I'm doing it through an audiobook, so chapters and pages aren't
right.
But you know, they seem to go through all the, you know, the Cold War CIA stuff, and he spends, you know, a little bit of time on each of the, you know, these CIA operations. But then I ran it, and then it came in, and it's all. There's like this huge section. I mean, it's almost it's an 18-hour book. About 2 hours now have been about Oswald and all the, again, a lot of the stuff that doesn't seem to be true. And I'm like, you know, because I'm listening to it, and because I know things like, and I think I know I did it in my show, like Oswald going to Russia and being able to enter and leave and stuff like that. I want to say that Oswald is almost like a paper doll that people dress up the way they want to dress him up as. You know, he's either a super intelligent loner, or he's this, this political radical, or he's this patriotic character, you know, he's all these different characters, and it's all, I mean, I guess from a, I mean, trying to, and I guess from the, for a rank and file, people who believe in conspiracies, this has to be totally confusing to to them, and that it play, you know, it probably helps perpetuate this myth of Oswald being the way I've seen it. I mean, anybody could have been in that building. I mean,
right.
Even, well, maybe not you or me, but, you know, and getting a hold of a rifle, because how do I explain? I mean, there's, so, you know, like, I'm kind of rambling here a little bit, because there's so much, you know, anybody could have been up there, and they don't really, almost like, it's almost like they don't really need a, you know, it's almost like you don't need a reason for, to put him in that building. It's like, you know, how do I do this nice? because there's, I mean, people get, I mean, there are people who did not like Kennedy. I mean, it's
right.
I mean, all my research into, like, I mean, Roosevelt's another character like that. There's people who loved him. There's people who hated him. And Kennedy seems to be another one of these characters. And I think even like all the presidents you get, even to today, there's people who love, you know, they love the president or they hate the guy. And I think if we were able to get the information from the Secret Service, I'm sure there's been plenty of people who have been investigated. Yes. Because, you know, Kennedy, you know, anything could have happened. So, and then it was just at that right moment where somebody had the ways and the means to get into the the book depository building, get three shots off and get away, I think is quite plausible. I mean, even though, you know, you get these experts that the rifle was a army, a military, old military surplus. You've got getting three shots off. Which has been pretty much just, a lot of the stuff's been disproven. So,
yeah, a lot of the claims of the conspiracists, like that you couldn't fire three shots in 6 seconds, it's demonstrably false.
Right. Yeah, the angles. I mean, of course, yeah, when you really look at it. But there's also, a Warren Commission's got a trail that Oswald bought this gun. I think it was a money. He bought it with a money order from a catalog. Right. We've got photos of him with the gun. And apparently there were fingerprints inside the gun. So at some point he had it apart. Whether he had it apart to clean it and put it together, or he had it apart when he took it to the building. We've everything lines up to Oswald. So I think, I would think from a conspiracy standpoint, trying to create, make up a magic bullet, or to make up, this mafia connection, or a Cuba or Russia or a mafia or LBJ connection, seems, you're definitely stretching the truth. And certainly, I see from, anyone who believes in the magic bullet theory, you bought into the lie, type of thing.
Yeah, whatever one you go with, whatever demon they want to blame it on, be it the CIA or LBJ or Castro or whoever, it has its own little make-believe world of facts that support that.
So I don't want to beat up the whole thing too much, because there is no conspiracy. I'd like to know more about Oswald himself, because there's so much built up around him, that he's these different characters, that what was really going on in his head, unfortunately, we will never know, because Ruby took that problem out of the equation, I guess. I'm kind of the opinion, and this is more of my personal, I don't think it's, I don't want to make it sound like conspiracy, I'm creating a conspiracy here, but I see Oswald as kind of a product of the time and of the place that, he's lived in the South. Again, there's all this mix of, that he was a racist or he wasn't a racist. We really don't know what he was.
Right.
And I'm not going to make any, I really can't make any judgments, but it would be nice to know, was he just a product of that time? And and what made him so angry at Kennedy? Was it really the stuff about Cuba, or was it about, the racism in the South, or the race, or whatever the motivation was that would have put him in that position? And I'm unfortunately we'll never know. And I don't think, I haven't yet found anything definitive about Oswald. I don't even think Marina knew the guy that well.
No, I don't think anybody really did, but I tend to be more of the camp that Oswald just really wanted to be somebody, and he was going to be somebody by doing something big. He had taken a shot at General Walker, a right-wing member of the John Birch Society. And so, he had already tried to do that.
Right.
But when Kennedy came by, I think that, politically he was probably more liking to Kennedy than most people in the area. But it was just such a good opportunity for him to make a name for himself that he couldn't pass it up.
So then you took a lot of this information and made a documentary out of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'd have to, for the listeners, definitely check Conspiracy Theorists Lie, because a lot of this stuff you know, that we just talked about is in the documentary. But then you take a really neat approach to it. And I mean, the first two thirds is, you know, you went through the conspiracy or through the assassination, then how the conspiracy built, the John Birch Society. I mean, I think I've talked about, I don't know if I talked about John Birch. I think I kind of, they seem to be this wonderful organization where they insert their wisdom in the right places, and then people pick up and run with these ideas. And I mean, there's a guy that I like to talk about a lot, John T. Flynn, and he started off as a New Dealer promoting Roosevelt, and then something snapped in this guy, and he totally went opposite of he actually, you know, opposed Roosevelt every opportunity. I mean, I've got a number of his works. He did a column in the Chicago Tribune. I believe that was, I think it was syndicated, but it was a country squire in the White House, and just attacking Roosevelt. And his name pops up every so often within where he tries to manipulate conservative groups, or he gets called into these. There's a book called The Big Rich by Brian Burroughs, where, I mean, I'm reading this thing, learning about the Texas oil men, and all of a sudden John Flynn pops up, where he had been I forget the guy's name, which one, if it was one of the big four, Hunt, Murchison, Richardson, there's all those oil men. And one of them was like a total right wing. And I think he was like one of the founding members in the John Birch Society. And he had brought Flynn on to put out do a radio program or to collaborate. So like, I keep seeing that, you know, this guy keeps popping up at the beginning of a lot of conspiracies. And, I mean, I hear him referenced by, Eustace Mullins. He's a Holocaust denier, really, really horrible person. And again, Flynn's name pops up within this, you know, and it seems like the John Birch kind of does the same thing. They play this, you know, the conservative, conservative political type stuff, and next thing you know, then you get these branches off of the names escape me, but I know like a lot of these conspiracy types have ties or have worked or have been students of the John Birch group,
right?
So
yeah. I mean, it's funny with any kind of political groups how you'll trace it back, and it's it's that way in a lot of things. I think, you know, in businesses, like the first person to come out with a business doing a new product usually fails, and it's somebody a couple generations down the line that gets it right and makes the business model work. But the same thing with political groups. The first time somebody is, you know, forms an abolitionist party, it's not very successful. But as time goes on and it becomes incorporated into the mainstream of politics, then, you know, one political party becomes more aligned with the abolitionists, and it kind of influences over time. And I think that it's that way in anything, and it's that way in the conspiracy community, that people don't even realize the kind of connections of, you know, like some of their ideas have come from the John Birch Society, even though they might have nothing to do with the John Birch Society.
Right. Yeah. So, yeah. So you made those connections and how they've perpetuated the created the lies. And then there's those who have propelled them forward. I see a structure where you have guys like Jim Mars, Mark Lane, these guys that have created the conspiracy. They're like, right. Then you get the second tier, which are the guys like Alex Jones, who keep propelling it forward. They repeat it over and over again, and treating the the first tier as the intellectual elite of the conspiracy right. world. So they keep it going, because they can sit there and say, well, experts, or they say, professionals have, said that this. Well, no, it's some guy, he made a bunch of stuff up just because he has a, I don't know if he's, because he's got a, the experience of, I could have spent 30 years writing books like that if I really felt like it. I'm sure anyone could. And these guys have made a business. They made a career out of writing books about Kennedy assassination, and pretty much every conspiracy has these wise men. And then you got the guys like Alex right. Jones and Glenn Beck. I think more modern, but there's been a number of. A lot of the Patriot Radio scene has these guys that continually perpetuate, and of course the rank and file goes, well, okay, yeah, this guy is saying that these experts are saying, so I have to. I can agree with that, and it probably fits nicely with their worldview anyhow. That they think there is an Illuminati running things, or the CIA is actually running the world, or that type of stuff. And
yeah, and it is an interesting mix too of right and left. Somebody like Mark Lane or Oliver Stone is typically way out on the left, whereas Glenn Beck and Alex Jones is more identified with the right, and the John Birch side is on the right. But they're united in this kind of worldview, the conspiracy worldview, that somebody's pulling the strings, and we have to get those puppet masters. And so they might see the puppet masters differently, but they're very united in their kind of their view of the framework of the world.
Right. Yeah, because going back to the devil's chessboard, what struck me about Dulles was that his whole philosophy was the ends justifying the means. So it was, they were happy to kick out democratic governments to put in dictators, because it would serve the purpose of preventing communism in the free world type of thing. And I see guys like Jim Mars in particular, I won't call him out as a liar, but but he's definitely pressing forward this these agendas to, and don't worry about the facts. We want to do this, and I of course I don't know what they're trying to get at. Are they trying to keep they're trying to fight communism that doesn't really exist anymore, or what's going on there? Because that seems to be a common thread before the Berlin Wall falling was, all this had to do with communism and keeping communism out of the United States, keep it out of the Western Hemisphere, keep it out of the world type of thing, And so there's so it's okay to lie about the magic bullet, because if we can pin it on the Russians or the Cubans, then the United States would, what the idea is that the Americans get mad enough and we invade these places. That game seems to be being played. I'm a little hesitant to think that, but it almost seems like our war in the Middle East now seems to be more of a ends justifying the means type of conundrum we're in. Like I said, it seems like, there's like this. There's like this agenda, and I don't know. Again, I don't know if it's to benefit the Republican Party, or if it's just to benefit conservatism, or whatever, or any of the. But meet an ends by and justifying the lies to get to that point, and I'm really not sure what's going on there. I don't think it's. I mean, it sounds a little sinister, but I don't know if how, I mean, I don't know. There does seem to be something about, and I think it's more political, you know, because it. Well,
as I said before, I do think that there is an interesting mix of right and left going on here. And I do think that all these people who have this conspiracy worldview, they tend to, you know, latch on to rather radical politics, and they tend to see anything that's happening in the mainstream as somehow wrong because it's in the mainstream, that somehow that's, you know, what's being forced upon us. And I think that they all tend to have that attitude that it doesn't really matter if they tell this lie or they tell that lie or they, you know, neglect this fact or they neglect that fact, because they see themselves fighting for some greater purpose to save us from the conspiracy.
Well, with that said, that'd be like the second, third ish of the, because then you take and you, it did a neat thing with, and you printed out a little booklet and it said, conspiracy theorists lie, and went to Dallas on the 50th anniversary.
Yes, for the 50th anniversary. And they're like the little come to Jesus booklets that people hand out, but mine was basically, you know, come to historical truth booklets. Okay. And they just said conspiracy theorists lie. And then inside it just described, you know, it mainly dealt with the so-called magic bullet and why that's a lie. And it said that, you know, basically, this is an example of all the lies that conspiracy theorists tell you, and that their worldview is not the right worldview. And so I handed those out to people in the plaza, and naturally not everybody was happy about what I was doing.
Yeah, because I love the reactions of some of the people, because you have them in the that's the one, I think one of the best reasons to look at it is just to see the reaction on these people, because they grab the book and they kind of like do this double take. And I mean, I don't know how much footage didn't make it to the film, but you know, it was so neat how these people would look at it, and they would do this double take, and they would look at it, and then they would kind of open it up, and then they would turn around, and then you had this dialogue with them. And that was the coolest thing. You know, it's like, I mean, there were some that grabbed the book and walked on. I mean, I didn't get that detailed counting, you know, that type of stuff.
But, right.
But it was like, you know, there were some that took the book and went, but others like turned around, and it kind of focused on one guy, and it almost seemed like he was, he started agreeing with you, and then he realized, wait a minute, I'm going against something I believe. And he seemed to be like going back and forth with his, you know, he would start, you know, because you would make a good, you know, make a point like, God, I'm trying to remember off. I mean, this is again, it's off the top of my head type stuff, but you know, you'll say something and he goes, well, yeah, I can agree to that. And he kind of like, it almost seems like he was drifting out, and then he comes back and, oh, but you know, and it was just so neat that back and forth between that. And there was a couple of guys. I mean, I think there was the one kid who, he was like, I don't know, almost like he was puffing his chest out and wanted to beat you up. Then there was the lady about talking about, have you ever, you know, challenging you on, have you ever seen a bullet? And, you know, and I saw you, right. because you're being truthful. I mean, you were being, I'm assuming you're being honest that you have never seen a bullet. So you're being honest to this lady. Yes, I've never seen this. And then she was going on about, you know, how she's, I don't know how many bodies.
Her big thing was that I had not been a hunter, because, you know, I'd fired bullets into targets before, but I've never fired into a living creature and seen the bullet afterwards. And so she thought that I had no basis on which to make my assessment about the assassination because I hadn't been a hunter.
Right. So I was kind of giggling through this part. I mean, this was so cool watching this play out. And so, I mean, actually, how long were you standing out there handing these out?
It was a few. It was a few hours. Unfortunately, the weather was just horrible that day. Most of the time, the weather's still nice, you know, and I mean, the day that Kennedy went through the plaza, the weather was nice. When I was there for the 40th anniversary, the weather was nice. But this was just the most miserable day. It was rainy and cold, and they had official ceremony that afternoon, and then it started raining for like an hour, and I waited until the rain was done, and then people started to trickle into the plaza, and so I probably had about 4 hours that I could actually interact with people before the sun went down.
Okay. Because I imagine there was a lot more going on, or was it, or were those the highlights, I guess?
Well, I mean, I tried to pick the highlights and things that could go together well, and I tried to show a lot of those reactions. Like you said, I like that, seeing people's reactions when they look at the booklet, and some people will just hand them right back to me, like, I'm not even going to consider this. And a couple of people who were very happy about what I was doing. So I tried to get those things in there. And then I tried to come back to these people who were willing to talk to me for a while and, you know, keep coming back to them and different parts of our conversation. But there were even more parts to those conversations that it got to a point where I just couldn't fit it all in.
Right. So, yeah, like I said, and that was the neat part. I mean, really, I mean, that was, I'm being fanboy here, but this is something that, this is really what, really sets this documentary apart from, all the others. You can have fun. I mean, documentaries are neat. It's a really nice way of, like we're doing an audio podcast right now. And, we can't throw a picture of the magic bullet. We can try to describe it maybe, but having that visual of the bullet would probably get more information across than just us talking back and forth. And that's what I really, I like the documentary format. So for me, being a history nut, I'm always looking for facts, new facts. And even as a skeptic, I'm always open to new information. So I drive back and forth to Detroit. I got a 4-hour drive every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So I've got an audiobook going. I haven't really calculated the hours, but most of those drives have been, I've had some type of history book. Right now I'm reading this one. So I'm always open to new information and trying to assimilate this new information in an audiobook, in a book in general. Yeah, I can get quite a bit out of it, but I do get a lot more, I think, out of the documentary format where it's visual, it's so on. So as a creator of documentaries, is that a fair assessment, or should I be saying, I'm sure you want people watching your documentary, but is that a fair assessment of documentaries?
I think they're a great way to get people introduced to subjects, and many times to really get to know something that, a good documentary should document something, and rather than fabricating something or manufacturing something. But, I watch certain documentaries, like say you have, interviews with famous people, and a good documentary really makes you feel that you've documented something, you've identified with them in a way that, an acted out story or text on a page can't do. And I think I think a lot of it is just the feeling of reality in front of a camera. If I'm reading text or I'm listening to somebody who's written down text, I think I'm very aware of the medium. I'm aware that somebody wrote these words down and I'm now taking them in, and I'm aware of that middleman. But when I'm just seeing something on a screen, There's a real power to documentaries because you feel like the camera is this kind of objective viewer that's showing you reality unfiltered. Of course, it is being filtered because somebody had to shoot it, somebody had to edit it, a lot of decisions were made, but it doesn't always feel that way. It feels more direct. It feels more real. I often tell my students, if you look at just the difference between, like, say my image of who George Washington was, as opposed to my image of who Abraham Lincoln was, because I only have paintings of Washington, he might as well be Julius Caesar. You know, it's so removed. But I feel like I have a better sense of who Lincoln was just because I see a real, you know, image of him that is unfiltered through an artist. It is a camera's image. And then if I see somebody like John Kennedy, where I have moving images and I have the sound that is all, you know, recorded by these devices, it seems like it must be factual because of that. It seems like it's unfiltered through an artist, even though the reality is different. So, you know, there's that old phrase that the camera never lies. And of course, people constantly say, well, that's not true. The camera lies a lot. But it doesn't exactly. You can manipulate photography, you can manipulate video, you can manipulate things by the stuff you do to it. But in an inherent sense, the camera does not lie. You put a camera in a fixed position and you take a picture, it will always take the same picture in that fixed position. You know, that there is an inherent truth to what the camera does because it's mechanical. And I think that people just instinctually think, well, you know, it was filmed, it's real. It was, you know, it wasn't filtered through anything, because they don't think of the camera as a filter. They put a certain objectivity to it.
Okay. So there's, yeah.
You know, I did a film called You Don't Know Hitler when I was in graduate school. It's up on YouTube, and it uses Nazi propaganda footage and shows the way the Nazis presented themselves. And then I tell you what was really happening behind the scenes. But, you know, their propaganda was very good at making you feel like you were a part of something special in this society. And it had a certain power to it because it had such a documentary kind of feel to it, even though it was very manufactured. But that inherent power of the documentary worked very well for them.
Because I'm kind of... Well, there's the, what was it? There's Michael Moore's, I forget if it was his Bowling for Columbine, or it was the one about the gun control. And yeah. there was a scene in there about him going into a bank where you can open up a bank account and get a gun.
Right.
And, so he goes in, he opens the account, walks out with a hunting rifle.
Right.
Where, but apparently the reality of that was somewhat staged, because normally the bank would have just given a person a voucher to go to a gun store to buy that gun. But they made a special arrangement for Moore to film this. That sounds to me like it's pushing some limits there.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of Michael Moore's. I think he's a very funny guy. As a comedian, I think he's very good. But I'm fearful that has become the face of documentary to so many people, and that he actually, you know, won an Academy Award off of his work. If you go back to even like in the 1980s, have you ever seen A Thin Blue Line? It's Earl Morris documentary, Thin Blue Line. And Earl Morris was a private investigator before he became a documentarian. And so he makes very interesting films, and he knows how to investigate things. He knows how to talk to people and get things. And he found this case in Texas where these guys were convicted of shooting a cop. And he was basically able to demonstrate that they didn't do it. that there was very reasonable doubt that it was somebody else in a different car that kind of looked similar to their car, and that they weren't the ones. And ultimately, those guys got out of prison because enough reasonable doubt had been raised, and the investigation was reopened. I don't remember if they got a new trial or if they were just let free or what. But it was a very important documentary that really changed these people's lives. But at the time, the thinking on documentary in Hollywood was so to the extreme of, we don't reenact anything. We don't set up anything. A documentary has to just document something. And so the fact that he did interviews with people and then had actors reenact what was being said in the interview, right away people were like, no, we're not going to nominate it for Academy Award. And I think, you know, that used to be the real extreme camp in Hollywood. And now, by the time Michael Moore wins an Oscar, it's gone completely the other direction, where you don't really have to document anything at all. You just have to pretend as if you documented something. And as long as your film is entertaining, you get the Academy Award. And to me, I find that very troubling, because it's dismissing the whole documentary aspect of a documentary.
Yeah, because I just, actually, something just clicked there, because, you know, I've got the AP handbook, and how for journalists, mm-hmm. how they're not supposed to become part of the story. I mean, they have to be, they have to be, you know, outside. You know, they can't be. Yeah, they can't insert themselves into the story. I mean, because actually, locally, there was Drew Peterson. I think he made national news for a while there, but there was a local reporter who had started hanging out with him, and actually, they caught him in a hot tub together. Going through the style book and the standard book there, that. You know, that you're not supposed to manipulate photos, and there's all this stuff. But then there's been these rare cases where, you know, photos have been manipulated and so on. I mean, there's definitely an ethics involved here. And like I said, I'm, of course, being kind of, I think we're in agreement that Oswald was a lone shooter,
right.
That, you know, I don't think we're going to, I mean, you know, the way we look at it, we'll look at other, you know, was it The Men Who Killed Kennedy, those documentaries, we can see through the lies. I'll start using that term a little bit more. I hate using lie, because I don't want to accuse somebody. Because sometimes I think these guys actually they believe what they. I think some of them actually believe what they write, because they seem to stand by it. You know, which I have to kind of give them some credit. But we know from the reality is that Magic Bullet wasn't true. I mean. So, you know, that type of thing. So there's kind of like a, you know, there's this integrity thing. And I try, I mean, I know with my, you know, my work with the show, I try to get all the information. I have no problem, you know, explaining that, you know, here's the conspiracy. Here's what these guys believe, and here's where they're wrong. I will admit that there might be some, you know, there's something that doesn't make sense, like with Oswald. I mean, I'm more than happy to admit that we don't know enough about Oswald to understand, and if he was manipulated or not, or how he was manipulated, or if he was manipulated, we don't know this. So there seems to be a responsibility to at least recognize those problems. But with when I see things like Michael Moore's, when I read there was like a, it was like, I don't know if it was a blog or somebody put up a web page about it, and they list all these things that he, you know, what he had manipulated in his films, and I go, right. You know, it's like, you know, I think, you know, it's how I mean, it's like, how can we trust, you know, it, well it, it it kind of shattered my illusions of Moore. But then again, it kind of said, you know what, I got to be more careful about how I, look at things. And that's why, that's what I like about your documentary, because you do hit the points. You pointed out everything about the facts about the assassination, how the facts have been manipulated, and then the reaction of everything. So I think that there is a, there's somebody, I don't know if someone ever comes up and says, hey, are we being a little bit, are we pushing the ethics to some limit that we might not want to be going?
Right.
I don't know, because it's,
yeah. Unfortunately, you mentioned journalism. There isn't really any kind of code of conduct that is agreed upon in filmmaking. It doesn't have that same sense that journalism has. And so, yeah, journalists might violate that sometimes, but you know what they're violating. In film, there's just artistic license can mean anything.
Right. Because that's where I start wondering about docudramas. I mean, the one I like, and what I got into was HBO did that conspiracy. It was about the WANSI conference in 1942.
And yeah, that's a good one.
Yeah, I love that thing and how they presented it. And it's not that we knew what actually happened in that meeting, but we know what was the outcome. That was the foundation for the mass extermination of Jews in Germany or in Europe. And I've read a lot about Reinhard Heydrich, who had basically took over the program, Eichmann. I mean, that's almost like if you don't know Eichmann, you don't know anything about the Holocaust. But there's the other players like Roland Freisler. He was the I forget what his actual position was, but he was, if you ever see a German documentary of the guys that are the one judge that's yelling, I think during after Hitler's Stauffenberg's attempted assassination of Hitler, you'll see that, right, that guy, the bald guy that's yelling at all the guys, that's Freisler. And he was at this meeting and he did a really nice job of, I don't care about, get it done type of attitude. But a lot of the players there I think the actors did a really good job of portraying what they might have done at this meeting, even though we don't know what happened, how they interacted. There was definitely, I would definitely say that this would be a good one to see if you want to get it. I think this would be the closest you're going to get to the WANSI conference without being the fly on the wall in that building.
Yeah, I think based on the information that we have, that film does very well, and it really portrays the people involved. We don't know exactly what they said, but what is said in that film is believable to who they were and the actions that they took. The problem is when you get into movies that they make basically heroes out of villains, and they really change the story. Obviously, you don't get that with Nazi films. People are still still wise enough to always make the Nazis the evil that they are. But you do get that with other things. Have you ever seen Birth of a Nation?
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah. Birth of a Nation is the first big Hollywood hit. And it is the big blockbuster hit of the 19-teens. And it is an extremely racist film that makes the Ku Klux Klan out to be the big heroes who saved the South after the Civil War.
Yeah.
That civilization was just falling apart because the black man was now in charge and they had to stop it.
Yeah.
And the Klan saves the day. And at the end of the film, the big end of the film is that all these black guys who are actually white guys when, painted up in blackface, playing these horrible stereotypes, they they walk out of their houses on election day, and there's all the Klansmen waiting for them, and all the black guys go back in their house. And that is literally the happy ending of the film, that they have stopped the black man from voting.
Yeah.
And this, I mean, this was American society in the 19 teens, and that was represented as history. And the guy who made it, D.W. Griffith, who, you know, as a filmmaker was very influential and a great filmmaker, but was a big time racist and a big time supporter of the South. And he said that, you know, in the future, this is how people will learn their history. You know, why read a book? You can see it on the screen. And I think he's right. That's the reality. It's so easy to just digest something off the screen and think you know it.
Right. Yeah. The other docudramas that I've liked, Too Big to Fail. But I've also read the book, and I'm like, there's that. There's Barbarians at the Gate. Because I've read the books, and then seen the document or the docudramas, and I want to say like the Barbarians at the Gate was probably a little bit closer, but there was a lot of artistic license thrown in there, and then Too Big to Fail had a lot of that too. So, you know, I'm a lot of my research now is trying to understand the economy and, you know, the economic crashes and stuff like that. And I'm actually more confused after watching those than I am I learned anything.
Yeah, I felt that way with the economics too.
I don't know how the I don't know. It's such a weird, and and even that when they started mixing that into the Kennedy, I mean, actually going back, because there was that executive order. I'm glad you brought that up in the documentary, because there's that executive order that's supposed to have abolished the Federal Reserve. I mean, that was actually that's an automatic red flag that there's somebody crazy out there making, you know, putting this stuff. You know, these guys that are opposed to the Federal Reserve. I mean, there's probably good reasons not to like the Federal Reserve, but there's the reasons that they have aren't really reasons. It's because it's, again, I think anybody who buys into the, and I don't want to use libertarian, but there's that libertarian view that, that we don't need a central bank. That's, to me, is a BS argument. I mean, there is probably good reasons not to have but I think there's a lot more better reasons to have, you know. But I'm actually still trying to research that, because I'm not finding anything wrong with the Federal Reserve. So I don't know what is the problem here. I hear a lot, you know. I hear stuff like, well, it was, you know, when it came into being and how it was. You know, that they forced it through Congress. No, that didn't happen. There's all sorts of little nuances that's for a different show. But definitely the conspiracy, I think, was really good. Whereas Too Big to Fail, Game Change, that one about the McCain Palin.
Sarah Palin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Recount was, I think, maybe pretty good. I didn't read that book, but it's like, you know, so there's like this, I don't, yeah, like I said, I think anytime when you deal with, and maybe it's just because it's politics and economics, these are near and dear to everybody's heart in one form or another. So it's kind of hard to, I don't know. Maybe that's why I have issues with those films as what they presented and how they presented. And certainly, again, there's I use artistic. I mean, I guess it's artistic license. I mean, is that a correct term? They mash stuff together. They leave out certain parts
my understanding of artistic license is, like I said, you don't make heroes into villains and villains into heroes. But you do things to like simplify a story, you know, and if you've seen the movie 13 Days about the Cuban Missile Crisis,
right?
Kevin Costner plays a political advisor to the president, a very close friend of the president's, a guy who went to college with Bobby and was Bobby's roommate. And so he's very close with the Kennedy brothers. And so they use that character to drive us through the story. Now, in reality, he was a political advisor to the president who did not do kind of daily operational government things. And so he was not a key player in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it is a simplified way for us to walk through the story and have somebody to follow through the story. And I think that's a decent use of artistic license. You know, I don't need to see 15 different people talking to the president and I can't keep straight who they are. Give me one character to talk to the president. That's artistic license. But now if you look at something like what Kevin Costner did in Oliver Stone's film, where he plays this district attorney that brought charges against a man for allegedly being a part of a conspiracy to kill Kennedy, that was a witch hunt. That was McCarthyism. That was the worst of American politics. That was somebody abusing their power to make a name for themselves and going after somebody because they could and because the guy was a homosexual. You know, it was completely wrong. But JFK makes it seem like he's this great hero.
Right.
And so to me, that's not artistic license. That's changing the history.
Right. Yeah. Because I mean, yeah, I think, again, that was another thing you made pretty clear. And because you even showed him being interviewed on what was the show, the TV show?
Tonight Show.
Tonight Show. Okay. Yeah. Because district attorneys shouldn't be doing that. You know, right. I mean, they're not supposed to be trying to sell the public. You've got to just sell the jury on if was Clay Shaw guilty or innocent. You know, you don't need to be going on late night television to press forward your case. And my research, because I think my first show was I did on Clay Shaw and, you know, the trial of Kate Clay Shaw and how it seemed mostly, there was that kind of a lot of circumstantial evidence. I mean, Garrison didn't have a good case and he was, I don't know why he hung on to it. So, you know, and hung on to this, onto the case and hung on to the idea. And, Right. But maybe it was the publicity. I mean, I'd hate to accuse him of being a publicity hound, but, you know, I guess, I don't know. Maybe that was what kept him going because there, you know, most of his witnesses were not the most reliable or would have been considered reliable in a court.
Right.
Stuff like that. So it was, but, you know, Garrison was, you know, I mean, he took it to late night TV instead of the courtroom, you know, and so that was another good point. But certainly, yeah, but like the JFK thing, a JFK movie, again, it's like, and maybe kind of, again, continuing on with the kind of I don't know if it's a degeneration of history, but then you get into the Titanic,
right?
Gangs of New York, where you've got these love stories in the foreground. And of course you got the Titanic sinking in the background or the draft riots in New York in 1862, 1863, whatever. I think there was two of them anyhow, but, I'm getting into mixed feelings like, okay, well, these are real historical events. I mean, the Titanic sank and you've got these draft riots, you know, I mean, the North was not, you know, the political world of the Civil War was not this pristine, you know, North right, South wrong, or vice versa, whatever side you're on the Mason-Dixon line. And other, you know, that Affleck Pearl Harbor movie. I mean, again, you've got some interesting historical points. I mean, you did have American flyers in England. There were, you know, of course, Pearl Harbor was bombed on December 7th. And, you know, of course, then there's the Doolittle raid, you know, in 42. So there is kind of like a, I mean, I did notice local, you know, around here, around where I live, my mother was a librarian. And my mom actually asked me, well, what movies should I recommend to patrons? And I go, well, definitely not this new Pearl Harbor thing. Because I mean, the Torah. I mean, yeah, again,
right.
There was it. But of course, at the time, I think a lot of information still was kind of, I think, being digested by the historians at that time. But it was a good presentation. But then you get the Ben Affleck Pearl Harbor, and it's like, you know, well, what gives? I mean, they you know, they put Doris was oh, you had a Cuba Gooding Jr. playing was it something Doris? He was a cook on the Arizona and grabbed an anti-aircraft gun and was shooting back at the Japanese. You had those little things thrown in there, but it was still a love story with a war going on in the back. And I see it on one hand, you know, getting people interested in history, but these movies aren't history. You know, I don't know what's your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I have mixed reactions too, because it does maybe get people more interested in history. But, you know, if you're just using a historical backdrop, you know, it's just your setting. You know, your setting could be set in modern day France. It could be set in modern day New York. It could be set in the 12th century England, you know, and any of those places you can have a love story. And the backdrop is just basically the backdrop. And so I guess I don't have too much of a problem with it, but if it does start presenting all these historical facts and twisting them up, then I do think that does damage to people's. I often tell my students that I think, you know, we all have this mental map of the universe and of how we got here. And when you get things thrown in there that aren't true pieces of history, you know, something they saw on the Titanic film or something, it distorts that mental map and it gets them kind of off in a wrong direction where they think that, you know, this is kind of a, when things happened, how we got here, and the path becomes very corrupt.
Right. That's a very good way of putting it, because, like I said, you know, because periods of time that I'm really interested in. I have an interest in the Civil War. Yeah, I'm interested in the Civil War, 1930s, 1940s period. I do have, you know, of course, my mom is being the family genealogist. Always some name pops up with who has an interesting, had done something interesting. I will research that person to, you know, find out. Not, I mean, we know who the guy was and, you know, where he lived and stuff like that. It's just, okay, so I always get interested in, you know, that, okay, he, you know, he lived at this time. So what would he be doing? Or what, you know, was he a farm? You know, we believe he was a farmer. Yeah, that's probably, if he's in Kentucky in 1790, yeah, he might have been a farmer or a hunter or something like that. Or, I mean, there's some interesting characters who had, so there's these neat little aspects of, you know, where I kind of dig into. So when I see, you know, so I'm always trying to learn more about what it might have been like to live in Chicago in 1938. So what it would have been like to live in Iowa or, you know, whatever thing. What was it like living there? And I actually go into the, I try, you know, there's definitely a wealth of information of, I could get newspapers. There was, I think I did a show for another podcast about, we did about vaccines, and I just came across, I think an archive just opened up with newspapers. I don't know if the Smithsonian did it or one of it. And I was going, well, let's look up the influenza. And there was this one town, and I opened up this newspaper, and all it said was, it had the masthead on the top, and the middle says no news, everyone out with the influenza. And that says that, you know, and that said so much more than the stories that would have been in that book, that there were so many people getting knocked down by the Spanish flu, or the, you know, the, well, at the time was, they were calling it the Spanish flu, but it was the, you know, it was the, I think it was a, what was the, what were the, what is, what are they calling it now? But I think it's the pandemic of 1918. And it's right. Like, but it said, you know, it actually said a lot more than what would have might have been printed in there. And so it was always striking, but it, trying to understand this history. And, but when you get a movie or something, documentary, TV show, whatever, that kind of messes with, fortunately, the regular television, you see stuff that, wait a minute, they didn't have that in this time, or they, you know, whatever. It seems to me that there's there's kind of responsibility to present things as doing film. I mean, I'm assuming, yeah, you can only get the camera can only see so much. You can only get so much out of the actors. Is that?
I think there's a limitation. I was just listening to an interview with the guy who wrote the Steve Jobs film, Aaron Sorkin. He's also wrote The West Wing and so many other things. But he was saying that, you know, this is not a biography of Steve Jobs. This is not a documentary of Steve Jobs. This is my interpretation of some key moments in Steve Jobs and some sense of who he was. But I have to turn him into a character on screen. That is just the nature of a film. I have to, you know, work within the framework of film and make a character out of him and boil him down to certain things. And other things are going to be missed, and other things are debatable. And I think that he, you know, I saw the film. I thought he did a really good, decent job of representing Steve Jobs. Now, Steve Jobs' wife, of course, disagrees, but Steve Wozniak, who, you know, founded Apple with Steve Jobs, tends to be more that, yes, the film got it right. And those are always going to be matters of an interpretation between things. But I do think that not every filmmaker goes in with the way that Sorkin does. I think that some people go in just saying, you know, this is just material for me to use, and I can make it anything I want it to be. I can, you know, totally change the history to fit the story I want to tell. And I do have a problem with that. I'll give you, I was just thinking two examples of the, you'd mentioned the conspiracy film. The other film about Nazi Germany that I think is one of the best films I've ever seen is The Underground. And in this country it was called Downfall. And it's just the last like 10 or 12 days of Hitler's life living in this underground bunker. And everything about that is based on what people saw and what people said happened there. Now, of course, their memories might be inaccurate, but the filmmakers didn't make anything up. They just showed you what the people witnessed there. And some people were like saying that they thought the setting was unrealistic, that you wouldn't have that much electric light in an underground bunker and everything. But the filmmakers, in fact, meticulously went back, found what kind of light bulbs were used, how much wattage they were putting out from the generator, and they made it the actual environment that they were living in. It is, you know, a very detailed, accurate film, and it is a very horrific film about how Germany is falling apart and these people are still looking to Hitler, you know, what are you going to do to save us, as if he's their god. And I think it totally tells you about Germany and about what happened there. But then you look at other films. I know years ago I saw Inherit the Wind. You've seen that, about the Scopes monkey trial.
Right.
And, you know, my impression from seeing Inherit the Wind is, these stupid conservative Christians, they were so anti-science and they persecuted this poor guy for teaching evolution. And boy, you know, what a bad thing that happened. And that is the Hollywood version that they wanted you to get out of that story. But if you look at what really happened in the Scopes trial, it's much more complicated than that. And these, far from being some heroic, you know, pro-science people, the textbook that was being taught in the Scopes trial was a very racist eugenics kind of textbook that put white people above other people. And the Christians who opposed this opposed it because they didn't believe that some people were superior to other people. And so you could very easily make a film, you know, 180 degrees the other way and make the Christians out to be the heroes and the guy teaching evolution out to be the horrible guy. And the history is probably more in the middle between those two versions. But I'm afraid that Hollywood likes to go for one extreme version or the other.
So I think we've did pretty good. We talked about your documentary, it's the history of Kennedy and film, I think the whole film world is interesting. Being an outsider and trying to understand the Hollywood mindset, and then of course, but you did this independent, right? So you didn't have to, or did you have to sell it to? I mean, other than your, you did it through one of the crowdfunding sources, right?
Yeah.
So you just had to convince internet people. You didn't have to convince.
Right. I put up some of the money myself, and I raised some other money for it, and it wasn't that big of a thing. I just had to fly to Dallas and hire some people to follow me around for a few hours.
I read this book about film. The Germans were trying to how they were manipulating Hollywood. I forget what the big studios are trying to get movies, because the United States was, even though one of their bigger audiences, they were trying to sell in Europe, in France, Germany. I think those were the big foreign markets for them. And when Hitler came to power, it's like, well, we don't want to see all Quiet on the Western Front. They wanted to edit it for German audiences, and they didn't want the pessimism or whatever the stuff in the movie. So, for me, understanding film, you know, in all the different forms, documentaries, docudramas, and just these various films, it's interesting how getting the story across isn't really all that important. It's how there's that part, it's like, but then there's also, now I got to sell this thing. I got to sell this movie to some, I don't know. I don't know if you want to comment on that or not. But it's weird. It seems, there's times where it just seems counterintuitive. Like, I make a movie that, I think it's funny. If I think a movie's funny, I got a script and I want to make this movie. And if I take it to Hollywood, I get laughed out of the town type of thing. But then if someone says, hey, I've got 2 million or 3 million already, can you help me make this movie? Then they might think, oh, okay, maybe we'll do it. Or, there's like a lot of these, I keep coming across these weird stories that, I wish there was is there a way to make sense of it?
To make sense of it?
Yeah.
About like how movies get made?
Yeah.
No, there isn't. And there's so many abandoned projects.
Right.
There's a recent book that came out about Orson Welles' last film that he failed to make and just dragged out for years and years and years, and still nobody has seen the final film because he never really finished editing it. But even that is so tied up between people who own different parts of it that nobody will let it out. There's another one like that from Jerry Lewis, where Jerry Lewis played a clown who was put in a concentration camp in, you know, Nazi Germany. And that's never seen the light of day because of legal wrangling. And then there's so many other projects that just make it to, you know, a script stage or a test shooting stage or something. And there's just so many politics within the system that just in, you know, even just personal politics of like somebody new comes in, an executive, and they've got these five movies they were going to make. And that executive knows, if we make these five movies and they're successful, I'm not going to look good because I didn't start them. And if we make these five movies and they're not successful, I'm going to look bad because why did I continue what the last guy did? You know, I'm the new guy. And so the smartest thing to do is come in and wipe out those five movies and start fresh, whether or not they're good movies.
Because
just crazy stuff happens.
Yeah, because even on top of that, I thought it was kind of interesting about The Bridge on the River Kwai. It was the original story. I mean, there was no women, no Americans in it. And to get it made, I guess, or get the money and to play it in the United States, they had to put an American in it and they had to have a woman in it. That was the requirement of whoever was, I don't know, the studio that was going to, or whatever, whoever was going to put it out in the States. The movie Zulu, I mean, it was based on the battle of Rorke's Drift in South Africa. And mm-hmm. The actual, I mean, the real history, because you have Witt, I forget his first name, who was it was his mission that the British had occupied, and he was, I forget where I think he was Swiss, but he was never there at Rorke's Drift when the Zulus attacked, and his daughter had never left Switzerland. And, but somehow, I don't know if it was because, somebody, you know, I think again, it may have been for the American market. They wanted, they needed a woman in the show, in the movie.
Right.
So they made up this little side story about Witt and his daughter being in it at the mission. And, again, it's like, you know, I mean the movie was pretty good historically. I kind of wish the soundtrack had the Zulu songs. I mean, you just get the English songs. You don't get the Zulu, because those were, you know, I like that movie. I really like that movie, and but it's like. Okay. Yeah. Witt wasn't there. Some of the stuff, you know, when they sing at each other is one of the battles. I mean, that probably didn't happen. All that kind of stuff, but it was, you know, it's just so funny how movies, they come together and, oh wait, well, there's that comedy. What's that? For Your Consideration, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen that thing. It's
no.
It's a bunch like it's the ones that like well, it's like the bunch that did like This Is Spinal Tap and Best in Show.
Yeah.
And this is about they're making a movie, and the actors are kind of like washed up has-beens, but they're all of a sudden there's like a buzz about them being Oscar nominees. So all this stuff starts changing, and they do their stuff like, the studio exec says, well, you know, there's too much Jew. Well, the movie is Home for Purim, It's like a, you know, this Jewish holiday, and then, well, there's too much Jewish in this. Can we tone that down? And it turns out to be, they turned it into Home for Thanksgiving and all this, you know, a totally different movie than what the writers, but the writers are sitting there, you know, like, yeah, we're proud of this and so on. And the actor, well, I think a lot of the, who were suspected to be nominated never did, you know, there's all sorts of, you know, like all this, you know, everything starts collapsing at the end, you know, I thought it was pretty funny, but it's like, I wonder if that's more accurate about Hollywood than reality, you know, what we kind of see. So I don't know.
Based on what you said, yeah, I think it's probably pretty accurate.
So, okay. So, kind of wrap this up. So you've actually got a new podcast out. You just started. I think you've got, as of this recording, you got two out. This must be the podcast. And is it going to be an interview show, or is it?
I don't want it to be exclusively interview, but the first three episodes are interviews with other experts on the Kennedy assassination that I've met through the internet.
Cool. Yeah. I listened to the Ed Cage. I forget what the second one was, but I've listened to that. And it was really nice to, you know, you kind of get the, I think the Ed Cage one, you know, you kind of get a kind of a, I guess skeptics or whatever view the conspiracy world. I think that might be probably one of the better. So I'm really liking that. And that's, so you've come out with that. How well is the your documentary doing, the conspiracy theorist lie?
So I think people's reactions to it have been extreme in both directions. People either love it or hate it. They give it 5 stars. They give it 1 star. They tell me this is great, I'm so glad somebody did this. Or they tell me that you must be part of the conspiracy. Who's paying the bills for this? You know, how dare you perpetuate these lies for the government? You know, so I think that you wouldn't get those extreme reactions unless the film had some merit.
Yeah, that's what my show is kind of the same way. I mean, it's either a 5 star or it's a 1 star, and they don't even attack the show itself. It's, you know, anybody can do a Google search and get more information than this show. You know, I'm like, okay, you know, I've been off on this on other shows, so I'm not going to go, you know, bore you with this story. If it's ticking off people, it must be doing something, you know, it must be doing pretty good.
Right.
So great. So any other projects is coming up, or anything you can talk about, or?
Well, for now, I'm going to see what I can do with that podcast, just to kind of continue to make some stuff. But I would like to put out some other documentaries, and not necessarily conspiracy, but I might go back into that world, but definitely dealing with history and our understanding of things.
Cool. Yeah, that'd be great. I mean, like I said, I love conspiracy theorists lie. I actually got to buy it. I want it from my bookshelf.
Good.
And definitely, it's something. If you haven't seen this, where can you find it?
So they can go to nomagicbullets.org, and you can pay to stream it or pay to download it there. You can also go to Amazon's Instant Video, pay to stream it or pay to download it there. And if you want to join IndieFlix.com, it's like a Netflix for independent film, then you can watch it on IndieFlix.
Okay, great. And if they want to find out more about you or read your, I mean, you have a blog.
If you go to JamesKLambert.com, And I have a blog there called This Must Be the Place. And then I played off that and said, This Must Be the Podcast.
There you go. Yeah. So I guess, well, thank you for being on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah. And hopefully your documentary, Conspiracy Theorists Lie, people get it, go out and buy it right now, support this guy, because we want more. I want more. And definitely, hopefully you have hopefully this is successful in, the podcast. I mean, it sounds like it's going to be a good one. And, hopefully, you do well with this.
Well, thank you.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
So I'd like to thank James Lambert for taking the time to talk about his documentary, a little bit about Kennedy, and hopefully you go and check out his latest documentary, Conspiracy Theorists Lie, and also his new podcast, This Must Be the Podcast. I'll have links to in my show notes, and you should be able to find them pretty easy. So in other news, again, I'm still quite busy. I've been working on a couple ideas for the next show. I had run into a mental block on one, which kind of messed me up a little bit, but I think I got a recovery plan here, so I'm going to say within the next couple weeks I should have the next show out, try to get back on a normal schedule again. And also, I'd like you to check out the Unseen Podcast. I've been doing it's a panel show talking science. I've been on it a few times. This is an extension to the Wild Podcast put out by Paul Carr, who does a podcast exploring the world of seeking out extraterrestrial life. He's talked to people at the SETI Institute and so on. So as an extension, he's done this Unseen Podcast where he takes on science topics and kind of free form. So be sure to check that out. It's a pretty good show. So again, thank you for listening, and we will try to get to you in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's mikebohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebohler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Tsarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.